You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Author and cultural critic Roxane Gay's work has garnered international acclaim for its reflective, no-holds-barred exploration of feminism and social criticism. With a keen eye on modern culture, she critiques its ebb and flow with wit and ferocity. She was the keynote speaker at Smith College's annual celebration of Otelia Cromwell Day on November 2nd, 2017.
It is a real pleasure to be here on Otelia Cromwell Day. I think it's an important day. Anytime a black woman accomplishes the kinds of things that Otelia Cromwell did, it's important to remember them, and to remember them not only in name, but also in action. Of course, it's important for that action to last more than one day. And that's the trouble we have when we talk about diversity and inclusion. Oftentimes, we talk about it for one day or 1 month, and we think that's enough, and we can be on our own for the other 11 months of the year or the other 30 days of the month, and that's simply not how progress and change actually work. And so the title of my talk today is actually, and there's a funny story behind the Roxane Gay is one N thing. Well, people always spell my name wrong, but I'm not the kind of person who's going to plan something like months ahead, and so I'm just like, you can tell them the talk is whatever you want. I don't know, because I haven't written it yet. The actual title of the talk is The Age of American Disgrace. On Tuesday, November 8th, 2016, Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. I spent the evening watching election returns, and with each passing hour, the hope of Hillary Rodham Clinton as our first woman president faded a little more. But I still held on to some hope, because hope was much easier than facing reality. Although I do not think myself an idealist, I could not allow myself to believe Donald Trump could be elected. I believed at that time that there were enough good people across the country who believed in social progress and the greater good to overcome those who, for whatever reason, believed in Trump's harmful rhetoric. It has been nearly a year, and still, I am stunned. I am ashamed of being so stunned and so unprepared to face this American reality. The morning after the election, my mother called, and I ignored my phone because it was 7 o'clock in the morning, but according to Haitian parents, if you're not awake at 7 o'clock, you have wasted the entire day. I knew she was worried because we had spoken throughout election night, and I was taking it hard. A few minutes later, she texted me, "The sun is shining today, Miss America. We are alive, still together, and definitely stronger. Wake up." Mothers. I did not want to wake up, or I wished that I was experiencing a nightmare and I could wake up in the world that we lived in on November 7th, 2016. An imperfect world, to be sure, but a world where an orange reality television star was not president-elect. I did not want to wake up in a world where everything had suddenly become precarious for far too many people. On the Wednesday after the election, I went about my day. I had to accept that the world was not coming to an end, even though it felt that way. There were media interviews, even though I had no idea what to say. I had no way of making sense of the incomprehensible. What do we do next? I was asked as a black oracle, and what I wanted to say was, I have no fucking idea. I couldn't say that because you're not allowed to curse on the radio, but I sure did think it. While I was running errands, the sun was shining, the air was crisp, it was a perfect fall day, people were out living their lives. At my gym, everyone bantered as they usually do. The woman at the dry cleaner smiled and wished me a good day as she usually does. I kept wanting to scream, "Don't you know what's going on?" At the same time, because I live in a fairly small town in Indiana, I looked at each and every person and thought, you probably voted for Donald Trump. How could you? Do you have any idea what you've done? I didn't write a lot about the presidential campaign, and I regret that now. I wanted to, but I did not have the words to express my support and admiration for Hillary Clinton, or to express my frustration with the narrow field of candidates the Democrats offered, or to express my horror that Donald Trump was consistently overcoming shallow expectations. That's the official line. In truth, I was scared to admit how much I supported Hillary Clinton, and I didn't have the energy to deal with the inevitable blowback whenever a black woman dares to stand up for Hillary Clinton. I regret that now. It's not that I believe that I would have swayed the election one way or another, but I know I had an opportunity to raise my voice, and I squandered that opportunity. Now, it is almost a year later, we have the president we have, and we cannot relitigate the election. Instead, I am interested in figuring out where we go from here. I am interested in figuring out how we survive this age of American disgrace. And let us be clear, to call what is currently happening a disgrace is my way of being polite. 10 months into his presidency, Trump has set into motion executive orders to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. He has tried and failed to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, but continues to hobble it. He lies repeatedly. He has spent so many weekends at his Florida estate or golfing and discussing matters of national and international security with no regard for actual security. He has tried to ban Muslims repeatedly from entering the country and failed. He has ordered ICE raids on undocumented immigrants, specifically targeting sanctuary cities. His national security advisor, Michael Flynn, resigned because he had discussed sanctions with the Russian ambassador and then lied to Mike Pence. Flynn, if you missed it, led a vigorous chant of lock her up during the presidential campaign because, you know, Hillary Clinton and those emails. Flynn remains under federal investigation. His one-time campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has been arrested and indicted on multiple counts, including conspiracy against the United States. Trump picks fights with Gold Star parents. He seems to take particular pleasure in demeaning black women and picking very public fights with them. He has done this with elected officials. He has done this with the wife of a fallen soldier. He has largely ignored the tragedy in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and it's still not at all clear that he understands that these territories are part of the United States. In times of crisis, he is not a source of comfort. He cannot be trusted with the grief or anything related to the American people. Instead of focusing on the business of his country, he spends an inordinate amount of time on Twitter, airing grievances, taking pot shots at people he dislikes, and defending his utterly shallow existence. This is the man the United States elected for fear of a woman president and in retaliation for the first black president. Throughout the campaign, I thought a lot about language and how careless we get with words. I thought about language because I'm a writer, and words are how I make sense of the world. There were all kinds of pithy catchphrases that became popular. Michelle Obama said, "They go low and we go high." And for a woman in her position, that made sense. She was beholden to the role of First Lady, and she was right in her belief that sometimes there is no need to sink lower than your opponent. But millions of people went on to parrot these words with no understanding of the world and how it really works. Too many people were and are invested in the idea of purity and infallibility to realize that there is no purity in fighting everything Donald Trump represents. There is no high road with a man who was appointed a white supremacist as his chief strategist and who continues to consult with him. When they go low, we have to be willing to go subterranean if we have any hope or chance of resisting their greedy, shallow, if we have any hope of resisting their greedy, shallow, insular brand of fascism. The phrase "love Trump's hate" was equally loathsome because that is in fact not the case, and over people were literally centering Trump. Language matters, and sometimes it becomes an empty container for whatever nonsense people want to fill it with. Go high, Trump hate, be nasty, wear a pantsuit. The election results prove that love does not Trump hate, not at all. As catchy as it sounds, I am not a nasty woman because there is no reclamation in how a man like Trump sees women. And while pantsuits are a charming and fashionable rallying outfit, they will not get us to the promised land. I don't begrudge people who found comfort or solidarity in these words and ideas, but my God, we needed to do better then, and we especially need to do better now. We need to get uncomfortable, and that means moving beyond tidy words that make us feel like the world is a better and more unified place than it actually is. Those of us in the crosshairs of the Trump presidency are devastated, but we must keep our eyes wide open, especially as the good white folk who voted for Clinton keep centering their whiteness every chance they get. They are ashamed of their country, and they keep voicing their shame, but I don't want your shame, I want your fight. I want to hear your voices rising above the din. Not enough people with visible platforms are facing the ugly truth of what happened last year. The majority of white men and white women voted for Trump. Some feminists are shocked that white women would value their whiteness over their womanhood, but women of color and people of color in general are not surprised. The precedent for this can be traced back to slavery. What we're seeing is American racism and xenophobia and misogyny on full display. Trump voters can deny reality all they want, but with their vote, they consented to everything Trump stands for. They now have to live with the discomfort of facing themselves for who they really are. What is reaped must now be sown. I have also been thinking about the phrase identity politics, which is always used to dismiss the concerns and lived experiences of marginalized people and to derail conversations about how identity affects the way people move through the world. Identity politics is always an accusation that implies that we can somehow separate ourselves from the very things that contribute to who we are. It implies that we can't both acknowledge and embrace our identities and be part of a larger community. I am a Black bisexual woman. I am a Haitian American. I am a Libra. That's really the most important thing about me. I grew up middle class and then upper middle class. I am fat. I am a very lapsed Catholic. I know little of safety. My identity is political because so much of who I am is part of the public discourse, subject to legislation, subject to discrimination and disadvantage. Clearly, this is not the entirety of my life and who I am. Don't get me wrong, I've got it really good. In fact, the work I do is not for me. It's for the people who do not have the privilege I do, who need someone to stand and speak and fight for them, with them. This is how I must use my freedom to speak. February is Black History Month, and in February, and frankly every month of the year, I am invited to events like these with a vague mandate to speak on diversity. And that wasn't what happened here. And that word becomes another empty container that people fill with whatever bullshit they want. Basically, I am invited to talk to and teach white people about things that are largely pretty easy to figure out. I, like many people of color, am asked for solutions to problems I had no hand in creating. I'm gonna let you in on a secret. I don't know how to fix racism. I will be honest. I am so very tired of talking about diversity. I am so tired of the assumption that as a Black woman, I somehow have access to some magical Negro wisdom about how to make the world a better and more inclusive place. The word diversity has, as of late, become so overused that it's often meaningless. In a 2015 article for the New York Times Magazine, Anna Holmes wrote about the dilution of the word diversity, and she attributed its loss of meaning to a combination of overuse, imprecision, inertia, and self-serving intentions. The word diversity is, in its most imprecise uses, a placeholder for issues of inclusion, recruitment, retention, and representation. Diversity is a problem seemingly without solutions. We talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, and nothing much ever seems to change. This is another way in which we are careless with language, as if by simply saying the word diversity, we're doing something or creating change. That's not at all how it works. Change requires intent and effort and material support, which in most cases is robust and long-term financial commitment. And always, change requires a little or a lot of imagination, a willingness to think differently, react differently, and act differently. I've also been thinking about allies, and I am done with allyship, particularly when the word ally is used as a noun rather than a verb. I am done with people allowing themselves the comfortable distance. I am done with people allowing themselves the comfortable distance afforded by allyship. I don't want to allow myself that comfortable distance. We cannot afford distance anymore, none of us. The challenges marginalized people are going to be facing for the foreseeable future have to be taken on by all of us as personal. We have to fight for and with each other. Since last November, people have asked me, what do we do next? And I have no idea, but I am always trying to find answers to that question. I know we have to fight, even if we do not yet know what that fight looks like. I know that we need sanctuary. I know we need to raise our voices and keep them raised. We need, as today's theme says, to resist, act, and persevere. We need to find ways to do this while honoring our hurt and our rage, because anger is an entirely reasonable response to the state of the world. We as everyday citizens must participate in our local elections, our midterm elections, and the 2020 presidential election. We need to prioritize social and economic justice and use our privilege for more than just ourselves. We need to keep protesting no matter how exhausted we get, because exhaustion is a luxury. We need to strengthen our communities by understanding where strength among us is most needed. We need to run for office, or at least you do, because I'm never going to run for office. We need to be disciplined and well organized. We need a whole lot of money. We need to protect ourselves and each other. Most importantly, when we use our words, we have to do so with care and intent. Words mean things. I have to believe that we are going to get through this, and we will not only survive, but thrive. It is a fragile hope, but despite everything, I hold on to a little hope. I need to be able to breathe. We all do. I need to believe that there is grace beyond this age of American disgrace. Thank you very much.
Roxane Gay spoke at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts on November 2nd, 2017. Our special thanks to all those who helped make this recording possible. You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. For New England Public Radio, I'm Dave Sears.